Welcome to the Valley Brook Community Church podcast, and thank you for joining us online today. You're about to hear a message from our current series, Sunday School. For those of us who grew up in Sunday school, there are stories from the Bible that we will never forget. We are taking a fresh look at these stories and placing them into the context of the greater biblical story. To watch any of our previous messages or learn more about what is happening at Valley Brook, we encourage you to visit www.valleybrook.cc. Enjoy!
Good morning, everybody. My name is Pastor Brian. I am honored to be able to speak with you this morning. I have to address something real quick. My wife, who came up in the beginning and said that she is married to me, she said, "Hi, my name is Jenna, and I'm married to Pastor Brian." It's weird to say that. Is it weird that I'm a pastor now, or is it weird that we're married? Which one was weird? I just want to double check. Okay, I just want to just want to make sure, you know? That's really weird to say that. You're like, whoa. I'm working on it. I'm trying to do good. Oh, man, it's fun to laugh together. Actually, I'm still laughing from last week's intro, if you guys were here, when we gave Pastor Clark the birthday king sash and the glasses that we gave him. He is such a good sport with all the craziness that we do here and that we bring. And so it was just fun to laugh together as a church, just to just have some joy. You know, and it brought me, that experience last week just got me thinking about something that's been rolling through my head for the last couple years. I've shared with a few of you guys this, but I want to kind of talk more about it together as a whole. What is the role of laughter and humor in following Jesus? Does the Bible give room for laughter? Have you ever read the Bible and thought, like, about that realm of human emotion? Like, there's joy, obviously. We have joy. We talk about peace. We talk about hope and faith. But what about laughter and humor? Have you ever found a part in the Bible where you found yourself laughing? Not at it, but with it. You know, and so it made me think about, what does humor actually do for us? And so humor, as I was thinking about it, I think humor has a lot to do with recognizing patterns that we didn't notice before. When we see something, typically when we're living our life and kind of doing the unconscious, just like autopilot that we're living, we can just kind of move from moment to moment. But sometimes things happen or someone brings out something that kind of breaks that unconscious mold, and we see it and we go, oh, that's a pattern. That's something I never really noticed. And then when you do that together in a group of people, it becomes funny. You laugh and go, I've never really thought about it that way before. I'll give you an example. Did you guys know that Adam and Eve were the first people to ignore Apple's terms and conditions? Yeah? See, pattern, broken, laughter. Or did you know this? Yeah, I don't know if you guys heard this, but the person who invented the Hokey Pokey just passed away. It was an absolute tragedy at their funeral. They couldn't even get him in the casket. See, they put his right foot in. It's the late ones that get me. It's the, like, they have to come, and you put your right, you know, so it's those, just, you see a pattern and it breaks. And then when you see it, it's funny, unless you're my mother-in-law and my wife, because then you don't think it's funny because you've heard it before. So, you know, those ones you've heard. Do you know I get booed when I make a joke with my family? I will get booed at the dinner table. I'll make a pun and they'll just go, ah, boo. Ugh. It keeps me humble. But I think humor, it doesn't just make us laugh, it helps us see. It helps us see things a little differently. And that's what I think that is a very important part when it comes into the Bible, because oftentimes many writers in the Bible will utilize this to help us see differently. If you read through the prophets try different attempts to try to get us to notice things differently. They try to break our mold so that way once we see differently, we live differently. And so you oftentimes, I don't know if you're familiar with the book of Ezekiel, the prophet Ezekiel did these like stage performances out in the, you know, the community and did things for people to see, and different writers, they use different kind of language, not to try to just crack jokes, but to make people see things they didn't notice before. And so I think that this is a lot of biblical writers think about this, is the next, it's what's happening in our next stop.
You know, this whole summer we've been focusing on one subject. We've been going through all the classic biblical stories. And this morning we're going to talk about the book of Daniel, one of the stories in the book of Daniel. And the reason I bring this up as humor is that the author of the book of Daniel utilizes humor to help people see things that they didn't before. Now, in no way am I saying that the book of Daniel is a joke book. Absolutely not. It is not. But it is a method of communication that the author uses. He wants us to notice patterns. So what he does is that he brings things out. He makes them extra. He brings things out for us to see, almost in a place where it seems almost ridiculous. So much so that we can't not see it. And again, once we see it, we can't quite look at things the same way again, because that's the goal. Once we see something differently, we treat it differently when we encounter it again. We don't encounter it the same way that we did before. We see differently so we can live differently. So I want to provide you a little bit of context. So at this point during the biblical history, we have Israel as a nation, and they fractured. They've become a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. They had a little mini civil war and they broke. And then from then, the northern kingdom, as we learned a little bit last week, got conquered by the nation of Assyria. And they were taken over. And so now all was left was the southern kingdom of Judah. But then another nation comes in, Babylon comes in and conquers both the northern and the southern nation. Now Israel as a nation is no longer a thing. They have now fully been conquered. And so what happens in the story is we hear about a time when Babylon came in and they plundered the capital city of Israel, Jerusalem, the holy city. They've conquered and plundered it, taking many of the things out of the temple and scattering many people into exile. And one of the things that happened, this is a little bit of a history note, that one time that when nations, when they conquer different nations, one of the things that they will do to keep control over the places they conquered is what they will do is they will take members of the kingly or priestly lines and they will take them and bring them into their kingdom and they'll kind of butter them up. They'll cut ties from every other god or religion or imperial kind of connection. And what they'll try to do is kind of buy them to follow the new one. So what they would do is they would take people from the kingly line. And what they did here in Israel is they took multiple people from the line of David. They took them from their homes. They actually made some of them eunuchs to make sure that they wouldn't even focus on their own families. And they tried to buy their allegiance in a way to try to help them worship and focus on just Babylon and to forsake everything about Israel, about who they were supposed to be. And so as this is happening, some of the people, we get to hear a little bit about their story. And so one of the things that would happen is that they would take these people and they would feed them really well. They would give them lots of money. They would treat them like kings. And that way, people in the nation of Israel can be governed by people that knew them and knew their ways, but now they're under a different allegiance. This would stop rioting from breaking out. It's taking the government officials and then just buying their allegiance to somebody else. And so here are the major players that we have. We have the king of Babylon. His name is Nebuchadnezzar. And then we have four friends. We have Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And they were all given different names when they went into Babylon, and those names you might be more familiar with. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And so this is where the humor starts a little bit. So I was having a conversation a couple months ago with our students director, Louis Franco, who just got back, so it's awesome I get to say this right when you get back, which I love. And he just goes, dude, just look up the names of these guys and look up what they mean, and you already know how the whole story's gonna go. You don't even need to look any further than just the names. So this is what their names mean. So Daniel's name means, God is my judge. Hananiah's name means, the Lord is gracious. And then we have, the Lord has helped me. And we have, who else is like God? Those are the names of the characters in this story. Is it not obvious by their names what we should remember from this already? I kind of feel like we get a little bit of a sneak peek already. Why should we trust God when tough times happen? He is our judge. The Lord is gracious. The Lord has helped me. And who else is like God? Isn't that so cool? So it's almost like they just planted that right at the beginning just to be like, let's just see how the rest of this goes. So here's another thing and the biblical authors did with this book, and I just want us to all be aware of this because not everyone may know this. We've spoken about how many of the biblical authors, when they write their stories, have the book of Genesis in mind when they write. And they write specifically in mind with the Garden of Eden story with Adam and Eve, because in that story, the whole human condition played out. It is where God instructed people on what he wanted us to be and what our job was supposed to be, and then the problem that led us away from God, where we chose to try to exalt ourselves by our own wisdom and in our own name rather than God's. And so the biblical writers see this human condition playing out all over the place, so what they try to do is try to use almost like Eden language, like Garden of Eden imagery. I was talking to Pat Fitzgerald about this. It's almost like there's a music track in the background playing, and you can't not hear it while you read it, but it helps you focus. And so Daniel is written in a way that should make us remember Genesis, where God's people are once again living in a world where another kingdom is offering them a different kind of wisdom. And where they're offering him a different way of living and another way of defining what is good and what is evil. And once again, God's people have the choice to decide, whose wisdom will we trust? So the story starts off, and the first thing they are tempted with is Nebuchadnezzar gives them the finest meat and the finest wine for them to drink. And I said how like they try to butter up these members of the kingly line to be able to kind of buy their allegiance. And so what's happening here is that there's a commander in charge of these friends here, and they are being brought in, and they are basically just being stuffed, being bought and buttered up with everything this new nation has to offer to try to win their allegiance, to try to abandon their Jewish roots and their loyalties and become a part of the king's posse, his group of people, and worship only his power and his kingdom. And so Daniel and his friends refuse to abandon their Hebrew ritual food laws, even in the midst of abandoning God's purpose for them. So it's an interesting line that they take, and this is something I want everyone to be aware of. In the middle of a hostile nation, a nation that is not for God, they are now living in a land that is no longer theirs, really. They didn't burn it down, nor did they worship the nation. Instead, they stayed in there and sought the good of it by worshiping God and God alone. Interesting line in between there that we'll start to see as we go through this. And so Daniel and his friends refuse to abandon it. So what they say is they tell the authorities, we're not going to eat the meat and drink the wine that we've been offered. Instead, we're going to eat only vegetables and drink water. And it's interesting in this. Now, it's not saying anything about meat eating versus vegetarian eating. They're not trying to make any kind of claim here. But it is funny to see that they take an Eden-based diet, a diet of only vegetables and water, which is what Adam and Eve ate in the garden, that they didn't eat meat in the garden. And so it's interesting that even they have Genesis in their minds as they're making this decision. And so the commander in charge of this process, again, this is very normal, this is what nations would do frequently, he gets really worried because it's going to be very abundantly clear to anybody who works for Babylon that they're not doing the same things. When you eat a lot of meat and you drink a lot of wine and you get buttered up with all these different things, a sign that they were bought by the new nation is that they would gain a lot of weight. They would gain a lot of weight, and it shows that they were buttered up. They were given everything they wanted. Back in times, if someone had gained a lot of weight, it showed that they had a lot of wealth, that they had a lot of resources, that they had enough to continue to eat, to indulge themselves more. And so, if they didn't, that they would be seen as people who were resisting. So the commander got very worried that if they don't do this, he was going to get in trouble, because that was a sign that they would see that they were successful in it. So God blesses them as they eat only vegetables and water, and it says they gained more weight than everybody else. Isn't that kind of funny? I don't know if you guys know this, and I'm not saying anything, I'm not putting boo to this at all. People have taken this passage and created a Daniel diet from this section, and so people eat only vegetables and water, and I just can't seem to find the continued humor in that people eating vegetables and water gained more weight than everybody else did. I told this to Peter Gove, and the two of us were like, huh, yeah, that's why diets don't work. So we're gonna stick with pizza. I'm just kidding. Don't take that seriously, please. Eat vegetables, they're good. But from their faithfulness in not choosing the fruit that brings knowledge, they followed what God had instructed for them, and God blesses them. And funny enough, in this, God blesses them with wisdom and knowledge and stature, and they actually became some of the top guys in Babylon in this position. And so one of the things here that the story lays out is that even in the midst of being thrown into a wilderness, of a new nation conquering everything that you once knew, God can still plant a garden. That God can still do great things, and his plan has not finished. He has not been beaten. So the next trial comes up, and the king has this dream, and he turns to all of his wise men and his magicians for help. But instead of just telling them the dream, he says, well, I have this dream and I need someone to interpret, but I'm not gonna tell you the dream. I need you to tell me the dream and then what it means. And if you attempt and you fail, I'll basically tear you apart. But if you get it right, I'll give you everything you want. It's just nuts, absolutely nuts. And so everyone else is like, this is ridiculous. No one can do this at all. It almost sounds like the Pharaoh and Joseph story in the earlier scriptures, but this case, Nebuchadnezzar brings it to like the next level. But God blesses Daniel with the answer. And Daniel comes in and he tells him of this dream, and he says it's this mighty statue that Nebuchadnezzar sees, a mighty statue made of different metals, all used in different areas of war. And they're also symbolized different nations. They're going to be coming, each more violent than the last. And it says, Nebuchadnezzar, he is the head made of gold at the top. And then God hurls a stone at the feet of the statue, knocking it over and destroying it. And from the rubble of that statue, a mountain is formed. And that mountain is to symbolize that God will strike down the future nations that use violence, and he will create himself a nation that will last forever, a nation that cannot be torn down, a holy nation bringing salvation to the whole world. So Nebuchadnezzar sees this, and he acknowledges God as who he is, and he praises Daniel. But he can't get the statue out of his head. So as he's starting to think through this, he goes, you know what? I know what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna do the exact normal thing another person would do. I'm gonna build that same statue, but I'm only gonna build it out of the gold at the head. I'm gonna build it fully in my image. And he's gonna set it up, and he declares that everyone in his kingdom needs to worship it. He's totally missed the point. Totally missed that God's gonna be victorious. Instead, he tries to set it up in his own image and calls everyone to worship it. And so in this, it brings us to my favorite section of this, where Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego come face to face with worshiping the statue or the punishment of being thrown into a fiery furnace. And I'm gonna read this next passage, and this is where the humor comes in. Because, and this is something that's typically not seen unless you read the scriptures in the manner that most of the people in human history read it, which was it's read aloud to you. Oftentimes when you read this yourself, you don't always pick up on this. Trust me, you won't miss this. And so while I read this out loud, I want you guys to see the humor and see how it's pointing you to see things differently. It says, Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made a statue of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits and the width was 6 cubits. And he set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, also sent word to assemble the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the chief treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the administrators of the provinces to come to the dedication of the statue that Nebuchadnezzar, the king, had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the chief treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the administrators of the provinces were assembled for the dedication of the statue that Nebuchadnezzar, the king, had set up. And then they stood before the statue that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "To you the command is given, you peoples, nations, populations of all languages, that at the moment you hear the sound of the horn and the flute, the lyre, the trigon, the psaltery, the bagpipe, and all kinds of musical instruments, you are to fall down and worship the golden statue that Nebuchadnezzar, the king, had set up. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall be immediately thrown into the middle of a furnace of blazing fire." Therefore, as soon as all the people heard the sounds of the horn and the flute and the lyre and the trigon, the psaltery, the bagpipe, and all kinds of musical instruments, all the peoples and nations and populations of all languages fell down and worshiped the golden statue that Nebuchadnezzar, the king, had set up. For this reason, at the time, certain Chaldeans came forward and brought charges against the Jews. I lost my place. Hold on. They began to speak and said to Nebuchadnezzar, the king, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every person who hears the sound of the horn and the flute and the lyre and the trigon and the psaltery and the bagpipe and all kinds of musical instruments is to fall down and worship the golden statue. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall be thrown in the middle of a furnace of blazing fire. There are certain Jews from whom you've appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have disregarded you. They do not serve your gods, nor do they worship the golden statue which you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, you almost expected to say the king, says, "in rage and anger gave orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then these men were brought forward, the king. Nebuchadnezzar began speaking and said to them, 'Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods, nor worship the golden statue that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, at the moment you hear the sound of the horn and the flute and the lyre and the trigon and the psaltery and the bagpipe and all kinds of musical instruments, to fall down and worship the statue that I made, very well. But if you do not worship, you will immediately be thrown into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire." And then it's almost like he slows down. And he says, "And what God is there who can rescue you from my hands?" So the author paints this picture of the pagan nations doing what they always do, bringing so much extra attention to their and worship to themselves. He does it so much, he lists it over four times in the bagpipe and the this and the that and the this. He makes this list so big, almost to say, isn't it a bit much? Isn't it a little much? Can you just picture all these government officials and all their fancy gowns and hats and medals and all the musicians and their fancy get-ups all just lining up and doing all this for the worship of their own nation? He's trying to make you look at it. If he'd only said it once, you probably wouldn't have even noticed it. But he's doing it so many times to help you see it's just people doing what they've always done. I don't know about you, when I read that, it just sounds like a bunch of peacocks flocking around and looking at themselves and making themselves look good. It almost just seems silly. And it's just Babylon saying, look how great we are. Look how awesome we are. Look at our name. Look at how great we are. And then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they see it and they say, no, we're Hebrews. We don't do that. We know who really is king. We follow him. Do you see this? Do you see the extra that he's bringing this to bring your attention to that? It's the nations doing what they always do. I don't know if you know about this, but it sounds a lot like the Tower of Babel, which was Babylon way back when. It's showing that they never learned anything. They're still doing the same human condition that happened even since the beginning. It hasn't changed. They're trying to exalt themselves in their own eyes and their own power rather than letting God exalt them through his. And so they resist. Again, they choose the line in the middle, not to burn it down and not to worship it, but but to stand strong to their convictions, to following God in the midst of a new nation. So they resist. And I love this next line, honestly, because the last line, right before they say this, the last one, I'm going to repeat it, says, if you do not worship, you will be immediately thrown into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. And what God is there who can rescue you from my hands? The next line I love. It says, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king. Real quick. So the Lord is gracious. The Lord helped me. And who else is like God? Replied to the king's response of, what God is there that can save you from me? It's almost hilarious. What do you think's about to happen? They say, Nebuchadnezzar, we are not in need of an answer to give you concerning this matter. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to rescue us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will rescue us from your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods nor worship the golden statue that you have set up. Even if he does not. Can we just pause there for a second? Even if he does not. Did that strike you a bit? Can we just process what that means? This is their mark that they are not like the rest of the nations. You know, when people idolize things, they desire to have them because they desire to have what the idol can give them. They seek after what the idol gives them. You see this with people. People fall around people. They follow people that have what they want. People who desire money hang around people with money. Wannabe dictators love dictators. I don't know if you guys have seen that. They love it because people who want power hang around people who have power because they want it. People who desire pleasure in their life, whether sexually or otherwise, like hanging around people who are successful in those areas because they believe that if they give attention and care to those people, they will get what they have. That is what idol worship is. It's a desire to get what they want from this thing if they pay homage to it. But they want something for themselves in the moment. They desire an outcome for themselves that they believe that that person or idol can provide. And we see people do this all the time. They utilize things they believe bring luck or power or success or healing. But for them, I mean, for these three, they trust in God instead. They look to God for their desired outcome. And here's the difference. Their faithfulness does not depend on them getting the outcome they want in the present. It does not depend on the moment getting what they want. Their faithfulness goes beyond it. Do you know why? Do you know what that's called? That's called trust. That's trusting in God. That's what he wants from us since the very beginning, is to trust that he has our best interest at heart, even if in the moment it's hard. They trusted him and they had faith that God was still going to win, even if they might suffer in the moment. Even in the midst of a nation flaunting its power and in the midst of a threat that they might have to give into, they trusted that God was still on the throne. That Nebuchadnezzar, O king, was not really the king. That God was the king. They saw all that flaunting of power not as proof, but as a sign that it was just humans doing what humans have always done from the beginning. Have you guys ever been here? Have you guys ever been tempted to take a path that would save you in the moment, but would cost you in the long run? That's what they were tempted with here. And so they sat together and they said, even if he does not, I still will, because I know one day he will. Do you believe that? Even if he does not for you right now, do you still believe that God will? So the story ends with them being thrown into the furnace. It says the fire was so hot that the people that threw them in were scorched and burned alive, but it says they were not burned. The three men that were thrown in, it says they did not get burned even at all. It even says their clothes did not even smell of smoke. They walked out of that furnace, and it says from that, that God exalted them and saved them by his power, it said that Nebuchadnezzar truly recognized who was king. And he said he worshiped God and acknowledged him as the one true God. Do you see how powerful that is? It was through the faithfulness of a few who trusted in God, who willingly took on the consequences of trusting God in the moment, and through their faithfulness and through God's power, even a pagan king worshiped God and God alone. Do you see how powerful that middle line is? They did not burn the nation down, nor did they worship the nation. They followed God within it, and everyone saw that light. Valley Brook, are you tempted to worship something that you believe will give you what you think success looks like? Who's asking for your allegiance? I'm going to invite the worship team to come up. What are you tempted to trust and worship because you believe it will give you security or success or control? Because the world is still doing what the world has always done. What we have to deal with today is no different, really, than what they were doing. The world still builds statues, still celebrates its own power. It still tells us what we should value. It still tells us what will make us successful, and it asks us to bow to it. Who's on the throne? Who's really on the throne? Daniel invites us to take a step out of that unconscious flow we're living in and to see what's really going on around us and to say, no, that's not who we are. We follow the true king. We worship him and him alone. Guys, we have a way through this. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego point towards the king who followed them. They point towards Jesus. The king who was offered the nations. Jesus was offered all of the worship in the world. He was offered authority and power and glory if he would bow to another name, and he did not. Jesus resisted that power because he knew who was truly God. He remained faithful in the face of harm and death, not because it guaranteed him an easy life, but because he knew who was on the throne. And when the powers of the world threw him into the grave, he walked out. He walked out in power and in glory, and he brought salvation to the world. That now there is a point where there is now the kingdom from Nebuchadnezzar's dream. That kingdom that can never be destroyed is now spreading through every tribe and every tongue and every nation. God was victorious. And he still is. Valley Brook, just because the threats and promises of the world are loud does not mean they're king. Trust in God. When those allegiances pull you, trust God. Even if he does not in the moment, trust that he still will, like they did. Our faith is not ultimately in what God can give us, but in who God is as the victor. There's a question that's been underneath all of this. Who else is like God? The answer? Nobody. No matter how loud they are, or how big their might is, or how many officials are shown around you. No matter how many people keep pulling you away, there is no one like God. Or the way the Apostle Peter said it, Lord, to whom shall we go? Whom shall we go? There is none like you. Now that we see differently, let us live differently. Live like you know who's on the throne. Let's pray together. Dear Heavenly Father, you are the King. You are the true King. Lord, you are on the throne. Lord, many of us have many allegiances that are pulling us away. Many loud threats or promises of rewards that are pulling us from worshiping you and trusting you. Being pulled away to trust in the power of money, power, pleasure, or honor. Lord, we may not trust in those things. Well, may we not trust in any other name other than yours. You are King, and there is no one else like you. Help us to remember that. Help us in the tough moments to pray that even if you do not in the moment, we still will, because we know you will be victorious and your kingdom will never end. Thank you for sending your Son to be the culmination of all of this, to fully make a way for us to live. Thank you. We praise your name, O God. In your name we pray, amen.
Thank you for joining us at Valley Brook as we engage in this series. To learn more about the life of our church and how you can get involved, visit www.valleybrook.cc. If you're interested in contributing financially to Valley Brook and to our ministry, you can do so at valleybrook.cc/give. Wherever you're joining us from, we hope this message blesses you and encourages you to love God, love people, and change the world.